Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 149, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. John-Pierre Hubschman of the University of California, Los Angeles. We spend some time discussing robotic surgery, its current applications, and its future applications to vitrectomy. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. John-Pierre Hubschman. Dr. Hubschman is an associate professor of ophthalmology in the Division of Retina at the University of California, Los Angeles in Los Angeles, California, where he also serves as the chief of the retina service at Olive View County Hospital. Dr. Hubschman, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
It's your first time on the program, and every time we bring on a new retinal surgeon, we like to give the residents and fellows some background on where someone came from, why they became an ophthalmologist, and then retina specialist. And your story is a little atypical because, unlike many ophthalmologists, you changed countries mid-career. So let's talk first, why did you decide to become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
So, big question. I came to ophthalmology because I was... Actually, I knew some people in ophthalmology when I was a medical student and got very interested in that field. So I started ophthalmology, and then during my first rotation, I was really interesting and intrigued by retina. One of the fellow I was friend with was a very good retina surgeon, and so when I looked at what he was doing, I was really excited and wanted to become a retina specialist as well. And so it was really, knowing people and knowing people who are doing great things, and I just follow the path. So, and since then I was very, very fortunate because I really enjoy that field of retina surgery. And so, as you said, I studied in Europe. I was trained in France initially, and then when I finished my fellowship, I had the opportunity to work in France and Spain. So I was running a clinic in France in the south west part of France in Biarritz. It's a small town in France, but where we had a pretty big eye clinic there. And we started a practice as well in Spain a couple of years later. So we had one clinic in France, one clinic in Spain in Bilbao and San Sebastian, which are both cities on the northern part of Spain. And after a few years there, I got the opportunity to join UCLA. They offered me a faculty position after 7 years spent in Europe. And, you know, I always kind of dreamed about the U.S. and moving there. And I was in private practice in Europe, and I was missing the teaching and the research. Even if I was involved in some research, I thought that it was in the private practice there, it was limited. So I decided to move with the family, and we moved to California 13 years ago, and started the practice at UCLA at Stein. Almost 13 years ago.
So I
became faculty there.
And you get to work with excellent and amazing residents and fellows at UCLA. Let's just before we talk a little bit about robotic surgery, which is where you've done a lot of research since coming to UCLA and before that, what about culturally differences you've seen in terms of medical training and medical culture, Europe versus the United States, working with trainees? Any big differences or similarities you've noticed? Or do you think that ophthalmology, retina surgery has become so kind of global that it's pretty much practiced the same way everywhere?
So I think it's pretty different, actually. When I came here in the U.S., I was really amazed by the amount of knowledge the resident and fellows knew about ophthalmology, all the different pathologies and syndromes and everything, much more than what we knew in Europe. In Europe, the practice is much more clinical. We learn on patient, and much less rounds and stuff about, you know, rare cases and stuff like this. But things have changed because I talked to my friends in Europe and they told me that now it's like more, it's done more like in the US. But at my time in France, it was really, we were learning about things in the clinic. It was very little classes all around. So we were, I think, pretty good in our clinical activities and surgical techniques and everything. But among the general knowledge and rare things, I mean, I was really amazed by the difference in how American residents knew so much stuff. But in it, they knew a lot of things. But at the same time, in the clinic, I was not impressed by the ability to really treat patients. You know, it was more like knowledge and less practice. And in Europe, it was much more practice and less knowledge. But things are kind of changing. As I said, in Europe, they are now the training program is much more similar than what's going on in the U.S. And so it's pretty similar now. But yeah, 15 years ago it was different. And at my time when I did my residency, when I looked back and look what I learned during my residency and what the resident here learned, I mean, I was really shocked by the difference. They knew so much more things than I did.
Well, that's true. And you know, let's talk a little bit about the evolution of surgery. And obviously, if you talked about the surgery you were doing back in France 13 years ago versus today, the technology has advanced tremendously in terms of the gauge of surgery. Although surgical principles have maybe stayed the same throughout the last 10 or 15 years. Let's talk a little bit about robotic surgery. So how did you first become interested in the idea of applying robotic surgery to vitreoretinal surgery? And what do you think are the current, where we stand currently in terms of applications?
So, I mean, I was kind of fortunate because at Stein, there's one area which is near the main hospital. And in that location, it was a center called the CASIT, which is the Center for Advanced Technology and Interventional Surgery, which is actually a center where surgeons and engineers were trying to develop new things and test current technologies. And there it was like a Da Vinci system. So I enter that room one day, I mean, just after starting at Stein, and discovered the Da Vinci robotic platform, which was, you know, at that time, a kind of new thing. And I started to play with it and to try to do ophthalmology call things, I mean, ocular surgery. And obviously, it was not dedicated for this kind of surgery, but I kind of thought, okay, there's probably something to do for ophthalmology. Maybe we can change it and so on. And so it's the way it started. And then I met some other engineers, bioengineers, and in like 10 years ago, we really started that project on defining what kind of surgical robotic platform could help for ophthalmology, what were the unmet needs, and how we can improve that. So it started really, you know, through that CASIT center where I discovered this Da Vinci system.
And then let's talk about what you see in the future. So let's talk about the criticisms people have had. For example, some of the old school surgeons about robotic surgery have been ophthalmology is different than other fields because, you know, we're under local anesthesia, the patient can move, you need the surgeon to have more hands-on control. I mean, how do you respond to these when you look forward to the future in terms of how robotics will be applied?
So I agree with you that there's a big difference between ophthalmology and the other surgical field. And for instance, the Da Vinci had many, many advantages for other surgical field, but they did not really apply for ophthalmology. As you said, we have a pretty good visualization system compared to other surgical fields such as laparoscopic surgery. We are pretty comfortable, seated comfortably at the microscope. We have a nice range of motion. We have good techniques with minimally invasive technology. So it's true that compared to other surgical fields, robotic surgery like the Da Vinci did not really apply or did not bring the same benefits to ophthalmology. However, there are still some unmet needs. For instance, there is still in ophthalmology a lot of guessing. When you dissect membrane, when you dissect TRD membrane and try to reattach the retina, sometime when you peel things, you don't know if you are really doing the right thing or if you are applying too much stress on the retina. There's a lack of feedback. There's a lot of things you are missing, a lot of information you are missing, number one. Number two, even if you have all the information, even if our precision or ability to perform tasks is pretty good, there are still some human limitation. And so if you can bring both of them, much more feedback and improve the precision of our maneuvers, then you can really open the door to new techniques or to better outcomes. So I really think that when we do, let's say, as I said, a TRD case or a complex PVR case, if you can in real time get much more visual feedback or haptic feedback, meaning haptic feedback is tactile feedback. So you know exactly what you are doing. You know exactly if you are doing the right thing or the wrong thing. For instance, there's something called no-fly zone. So if you are doing something and you are not supposed to do it, the robotic platform can tell you, can give you this information through visual feedback or through vibration in your hands, which is called tactile feedback. And so it can limit you to against doing wrong things. So the feedback is, I think, critical, because during ophthalmologic surgery for now, we have only limited visual feedback through the microscope. And it's most of the time not enough. And then if you can translate this information into a better motion and a very precise motion, then you can really achieve much better results. We have, you know, for instance, our time reaction, the human time reaction, 300 milliseconds. Our precision is, let's say, 20, 30 micron. And when you peel a membrane on an ILM, which is just a few microns, after a long training and a long training, you can do it, but it's still kind of tricky. So there are many tasks where robotic technology can really improve the surgical outcomes. There are many ways. So now, for instance, we built a proof of concept for cataract surgery. Cataract surgery is pretty easy. And if you have a platform where you have a real-time OCT telling you or telling the robotic system where the capsule is, where the material is, you can have an automated instrument going and staying inside the capsule or bag to remove in real time all the pieces under OCT control. And it allows you to clean up all the cataracts without touching the bag. So we've done, as I said, a proof of concept. We did the surgery with this platform on 30 eyes. And on the 30 eyes, all the cataract was removed, no capsule was ruptured. So it takes a little bit more time than human traditional surgery, but it's just a proof of concept, showing that with no human control, the system with the real-time OCT and looping the information into the robot holding the instrument, you can remove safely the cataract. So this is for cataract surgery. We are working on this. As I said, it's just a proof of concept. We are improving the system to make it more precise, faster, and so on. But this system combined with a femtosecond laser can really be the way cataract surgery will be performed in 10 years or 15 years from now. This is for cataract. For vitreoretinal surgery, I do not envision automated surgery. However, there are, let's say, for different tasks such as subretinal injection or stem cells or gene therapy, you can have during the surgery the real-time OCT scanning the retina, telling you where the tip of the cannula is as soon as it reaches the virtual plane between the photoreceptors and the RP, it stops. You get resistance and you stop the motion so you don't perfor the RP, and it can provide a perfect injection in the subretinal space, very precise. You can also, when you do dissection for TRD cases, the OCT will guide the cutter or the scissors to make sure that you cut in the right place between the membrane and the retina without damaging the retina. So there are many ways this system can really help you by providing a much better feedback on where the instrument is, how much stress you apply on the retina, and will limit you from doing wrong things. And so we for the robotic platform dedicated for vitreoretinal surgery, we envision a surgical cockpit pretty similar to the Da Vinci one, and then the robotic arms is dedicated for retinal surgery. And the big thing is you have real-time OCT scanning during the surgery and providing the information back to the surgeon and back to the system itself to create no-fly zone and to improve the precision. So, the big difficulty in this, almost everything is ready. The big difficulty is to process the information of the OCT in real time, because you have so much information that segmenting the data and providing the perfect information in real time is tricky. So what we do is, depending on what you want to see, we can, just use only one part of the data and not process all the data, just processing a few spots, telling you where the retina is and where the instrument is could be enough. And so it can, in real time, provide the information to the surgeon. So the preliminary test we have done seems to be very promising. So I really, even if I like performing traditional surgery, I really think that robotic surgery for cataract application or for vitreoretinal application will be part of our tools in 10 years from now, 10, 15 years from now. I'm sure about this. There are different teams working on this. I'm not saying that all project or all design will be the one used in 10, 15 years, but I'm sure, completely sure that one of the platform designed by one of the group currently will be used in 10, 15 years in our practice.
Yeah, I think the thing that always comes up later once we prove that something works is, from a cost perspective, is this something that's going to be viable? And obviously, costs with any sort of technology decrease as the technology gets better, more efficient, as more things become integrated. I mean, do you think that 10 or 15 years, that will still be, not only for the technology be capable, but from a cost perspective, to this be incorporated into practices? Because we have examples of technology in our field even now, such as OCT angiography and other things that may have limited applications now. And so many practices, for example, just can't justify acquiring the technology. But I guess your counterexample would be femtosecond laser, which really kind of spread very rapidly within a year or two of being released on the market.
No, I agree. I agree with you that, there's a balance between the benefit and the cost and so on. However, if we can prove in some time, let's say 10 years, that for that particular surgery, robotic technology is better, even if the cost is higher, I think that people will push for it and surgeons will want to use it. It's progress and we cannot really go against it. So, and medicine has been more costly. Every year it's unfortunately more expensive to get good care, but if the technology is available and if it works and provides better outcomes, I think that we'll have to to consider it. But I agree with you. I mean, it's if it's costly, if it's time consuming, if it's maybe the acceptance from the surgeon or the people won't use it as much. But I think that it's progress is something nobody will be able to go against.
Right. And one of the things that's interesting, just listening to you talk about this is eliminating much more of the thing. And I'm just thinking from a learning perspective for a fellow. I mean, we learn so many things, and yes, we'll have to learn how to use this new platform. But a lot of things you have to overcome, such as your, like you said, the things that come with experience, the greater control in terms of peeling and knowing where to move your instruments, understanding what's safe and what's not. But if a lot more of this could be standardized or automated, then that means that much more of being a good surgeon becomes principles and kind of understanding how the retina and vitreous behave. So it's kind of the last thing before I let you go. You know, you do staff fellows at the county hospital in LA. If you had to pick just a couple of things for fellows listening that you think are the most important, the things that you find that most fellows take a little longer to understand, that are most important to understand about vitreoretinal surgery. For example, when fixing a retinal detachment, that maybe just takes some time and experience to learn.
The fellows, there are some things which are pretty easy to understand, and you can just by seeing it a couple of times understand the behavior and know what to do. However, there are some cases or some techniques where it's much more difficult to really, really understand or see the details, which will tell you, okay, I can keep pulling on the membrane, or I need to stop. And so the goal of all the technology is to make everybody good, to make sure that all the outcomes of the surgery will be good with every surgeon. Okay, the phaco compared to the previous technology or any improvement in the cutters for the vitrectomy or things like this are making all surgeries better and all surgeons good. The difference between good surgeon and not as good surgeon is getting smaller and smaller with the improvement of the technology. And it will be the same thing with the robotic technology. It will less the quality or the performance of the surgeon itself won't matter as much with this technology, because it will help all of us achieving the same good results. So it's true that learning experience and so on is very important for now, but I think that with this technology, I mean, the training will still be very important, but it will limit the room for mistakes.
Well, Dr. Hushman, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us a little bit about your group's work. It's very exciting and very fascinating. We're looking forward to seeing, whether from your group or others, the technology come out. And again, one of the reasons we all love retina is how quickly it's advanced, and the future looks no different. So thank you so much for your time and taking time out of your busy clinic time out on the West Coast. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you very much. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 149 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also found our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. We have rolled out a new feature in the last couple months where two of our bright medical students, Mike Benincasa and Amy Klusterboer, reflect on the latest episode and offer their perspective. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are a link to subscribe to the Apple Podcast Store, as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcast Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Remember, Bluegrass Retina Consultants in Lexington, Kentucky is looking for a new surgical retina doctor. Come live in one of America's best mid-sized cities with amenities such as excellent schools, affordable living, central location with daily nonstop flights to 17 urban and beach destinations, a vibrant downtown culture, and famous bluegrass natural beauty. The practice includes competitive base salary, lucrative bonus and benefits, and guaranteed partnership buy-in after 1 year, which again, much, much shorter than the average buy-in time. Fellowship year stipends are also available. You can be as busy as you wish to be at this practice. And for more information, please contact Dr. Angelia Thompson at 859-333-7894. Many thanks to Dr. Hubschman for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Best of luck to Mike and his classmates who will be watching ophthalmology this week. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the